never wanted to leave you. You aren't a freak. You're just a good dog. I will never give up trying to get you back home.
Tendi, you have been an exemplary creator. But do not cry. I like it here. There's far more space to run and many fascinating things upon which to urinate.
Oh, wow. I'm so glad you're happy.
Well, the dog, then I guess this is goodbye.
Farewell, Tendi. May the suns shine upon you.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the animated bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, mite planting volatile seeds.
In the realm of lame assignments, that one, I don't think even you and I could have ever predicted that one.
Cam, when I saw the senior staff jumping around in those chain of command jumpsuits, my heart fluttered. And then finding out that it was because they're experts at germinating seeds, my heart fluttered even more. Like, I thought that was an amazing lame assignment. Maybe the best lame assignment handed down to the crew of the USS Cerritos so far.
Not just germinating the seeds, though. Maybe germinating the seeds.
Yeah, no guarantee at that point. Let's jump off from there, though, because, like, okay, I'm watching this moment. I think it's hilarious that they've got those, like, iconic jumpsuits on that always fun to see in TNG. And then they actually had to go there. They have to say, like, well, I don't like the babysitter Jellicoe captains. And like, it would have been a better joke, like, if they didn't have to mention the Jellicoe reference, though. Or does it work for you that they just call, you know, that kind of captain a babysitter Jellicoe captain? What's your take on that particular gag?
Well, I mean, that's a joke that only works for, like, maybe, do you think, like, 5% of Star Trek fans?
If that, like, how many people remember Jellicoe's name and know exactly the reference that they're making, especially with those jumpsuits?
Right. Yeah. Because I don't know that as many people obsess over Ronnie Cox as we do. You know, we have our separate Ronnie Cox podcast.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's all we record it, nothing but our jumpsuits until we get to the Patrick Stewart section of that episode.
I mean, I guess they wanted a reference in that joke. I think that completely works without a Jellicoe reference. I don't know that there's another captain you could throw in there that makes the joke more accessible.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, why do you have to go that extra step to almost explain the joke? You know, like, we already have the reference to Chain of Command, and then they have to go through that extra step just to make sure we get it. Like, oh, yeah, this is a joke about Jellicoe. Like, that's what I find the show is sometimes guilty of, is like, oh, they've got, like, a great sort of throwaway gag or throwaway line, and then they want to make sure that you understand it. And it's almost like explaining the joke, which to me doesn't usually make it funnier.
And it's also a little bit of like, no, guys, I don't think you realize how clever we're being. We're making a Jellicoe reference.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I am not going to dunk on any group of writers that wants to devote time to making a Jellicoe reference. I think I remember back at the convention in 2019, though, I think one of the writers, like, during the panel, either she had, like, a shirt that said, I heart Jellicoe, or she was going around saying how she thought, like, Jellicoe was her favorite captain or something like that. Either way, I had no idea that that would germinate into a reference on the series, but I was quite delighted.
Germinate. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was either a shirt or a hat, because I also vividly recall this as well.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a writer there that had a hat on that said Trek expert, and the joke was, like, she hadn't really watched Star Trek before getting on the writing staff. Like, she was there for her comedy chops, like, not for her Star Trek knowledge, which, like, tons of writers on that in that writer's room already has the knowledge. But do you remember that hat?
I do remember the hat. Yeah, I was definitely mixing up the two, the Jellicoe reference and the hat, which said, you know, Trekspert or Trek expert or whatever it actually said.
There's another writer who went to Michael Piller's wife's vendor's room booth. And I think that writer got her to sign the fade in book that Michael Piller wrote. So very memorable antics these writers were up to during that convention, at least.
Wait, did she mention this on the panel, or were you just following her after the panel?
No. Sorry, I should have clarified. She mentioned that on the panel. I wasn't like peeping around the corner, like saying like another Fade In fan.
I was like, this is one hell of a scoop.
No, but you know, she actually, that writer inspired me to read the book, though, just because she was talking about how it really breaks down just the development of a movie like Star Trek Insurrection. But it really does showcase what an unusual situation in that you have the producer hire a writer who stays the same writer all the way through. And he gets, like, Michael Piller got a lot more say than a typical Hollywood writer does just because of his relationship with executive producer Rick Berman.
Well, exactly. And I mean, even if you watch a movie and you only see one writing credit, there's a pretty good chance there was probably some uncredited writing going on set even. So it's really amazing that Michael Piller did as much as he did, sure.
One of the interesting things, too, is they he was talking about that meeting. It went on for like a week or two, but it was just him, Jonathan Frakes, and Rick Berman. They were just in like this bungalow and just breaking down the story, what's working, what's not working, what they need, what is filmable, what might be difficult. And it was just kind of this like triumvirate that was really interesting, because I think maybe in some people's eyes, Frakes is kind of more of a gun for hire. And this really broke down that, you know, Frakes was having a lot of creative say, even in the script stage.
Yeah, that's why I've always kind of proposed the idea of Frakes becoming sort of some sort of godfather figure for the franchise going forward, because it definitely seems like they want his stamp of approval, and it seems like he has creative ideas that I don't think he's imposing with those ideas, but I think he offers them up to the producers for sure.
I think that's interesting, and I also wonder, you know, how much LeVar Burton might fit that, in that he's got kind of the cachet, he's got the Reading Rainbow creds, he's got the Star Trek directing creds. He never got the chance to direct a film. I'm sure he would have wanted to, but it's just interesting that Frakes was able to make that ascension within the realm of Star Trek, and I think Burton's just on the next tier right below, right?
Yeah, totally. I think it's just doing those two movies. I think it's kind of like the Nimoy situation. Nimoy does Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 4. And it's kind of like from that point forward, he becomes, even though, you know, you look at Shatner and he obviously directed Star Trek 5, it really felt like Nimoy had a more elevated role in the franchise than even Shatner did when you got to like Star Trek 6 even.
Yeah, so, well, look, maybe if Robert Duncan McNeil gets to do the Voyager Paramount Plus feature film, maybe he can ascend, or another reference to Star Trek Lower Decks with Ascension.
Yeah, or maybe if he just does one of those Captain Proton short treks even.
I would go for yes. He does the Captain Proton short trek, and then that makes him top tier up there with Frakes.
Yeah. I wonder if Roxanne Dawson will ever come back into the fold, because she's obviously made her motion picture debut. I'd be very curious what she could do coming back to the franchise.
Yeah, did you ever end up seeing, it was a Christian film, I recall that. Did you ever end up seeing her feature film, her feature directorial debut?
You see, I would think you would remember the name because it was so on the nose. Breakthrough,
yeah. It's about like a kid that fell through like a frozen pond and was in a coma, and then they prayed to God and he awoke from the coma, even though the doctor said it would never happen.
That is correct, yes. And no, I didn't see it.
Is that why they wanted a science fiction director?
Probably.
I don't
know. That's an Academy Award nominated movie, let's remember. That was a Best Song nominee.
Oh, yeah. Was it like a Diane Warren tune?
Probably.
Think? Yeah. But it's just interesting, though, because like, okay, Roxanne Dawson is a top tier talent when it comes to television directing. She does a lot of big HBO shows. She's in demand. She did bring up a very interesting point at a panel maybe last year about how, okay, she might be an in-demand director, but what's kind of gnawing at the back of her head is like, well, are they hiring me so that they get the points because I'm a woman? Are they hiring me because they get points for being a woman of color? Like, she says like she believes she's a talented director, but there's always that kind of itching insecurity at the back of her, like that makes her wonder how Hollywood is really thinking about her own talents as a director.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously when you have those questions you're asking yourself and you're working in Hollywood, the most like unstable place to work in like the world.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think there's not a lot of people in Hollywood that you would call secure.
Very true. Well, maybe one final thing I'll just bring up before we go back to Star Trek Lower Decks, which is, I guess, what we're supposed to be talking about. But I think, you know how they had the S.J. Clarkson directed film that was moving ahead and that's just kind of been put in stasis mode? I just wonder if they're... I'm not saying that they hired S.J. Clarkson to do it because she was a woman, but I think Paramount had finally woken up to the fact that there had never been a woman director for any Star Trek film. And I just wonder if Roxanne Dawson would have been somebody who she had already proven that she can direct top-tier television. I've seen her directorial work on TV, on HBO shows. She is really good. These are effects-driven things. It's going to follow that Marvel mode where she, you know, can let the secondary directors handle a lot of the action sequences, what have you. I just wonder if she would have been a good shepherd for that particular movie that's now, you know, on the back burner.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think. It's a little fuzzy in terms of the timeline, but was she working on Breakthrough around that time?
It would have been close around that time when they were looping in S.J. Clarkson, but I think Breakthrough would have already been long released, like, or by the time that she would have been like in the throes of getting the direction going for this particular project. And guess what? That movie went nowhere eventually. So yeah, what have you?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know if her name would have ever come up. I mean, I don't see why not. S.J. Clarkson came from a similar world as Roxanne Dawson, doing a lot of prestige TV as well herself.
Yeah.
So I don't see why you wouldn't have... Because I know there's certain female directors who've worked a lot in TV and haven't had that break into films whose names keep coming up, like Michelle McLaren, for example. Every time there's a franchise movie or something, her name gets thrown around. And then... I mean, it doesn't seem insane to me that Roxanne Dawson's name was known or mentioned at some point. Who knows what goes on behind the scenes with the Star Trek franchise?
I'm just wondering, like, if the execs were debating, like, how many Star Trek fans out there would recognize the name Roxanne Dawson as the actress who played B'Elanna Torres on Star Trek Voyager, and that would convince the hardcore fans to go and get on board with the movie. Like, I just don't know if that really came into their calculation. Wild speculation on my part.
Tyler, this was a group that didn't want to promote the 50th anniversary of the franchise to fans. You think they were going to...
I know. That was so weird, though.
Yeah, I don't know if they were going to hire, you know, B'Elanna Torres if they wouldn't even promote a 50th anniversary.
But fast forward, like, 4 years later, and it now sounds like the Chris Pine, Chris Hemsworth movie is now their top priority.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to, the reason that movie, like, fell apart, though, is because they didn't want to pay those two actors what was in their contract after they had already signed off on the script, which they apparently liked.
Yeah. Although it's the top priority, we should say, at the time of this recording. I feel like they keep shuffling around which movie is their top priority.
Well, okay, because, like, just other news that came out, though, we had Noah Hawley. He is the showrunner of the Fargo television series. He had been tapped to write and direct a Star Trek film. I was super excited hearing about him being attached to that. And then he kind of confirmed what we all suspected, but essentially with the Viacom-CBS Paramount merger, he says, yeah, that movie's in stasis. It's not dead, but they're just trying to figure out their priorities right now. So that's just kind of a bummer to hear, too.
Yeah, there was also the rumors it was it involved like a deadly virus or a plague out there, which I don't know if that's accurate, but that was the rumor being spread around by Deadline and Hollywood Reporter. And they just felt like maybe now's not the best time for that story.
Yeah, I know. When do you think the earliest, though, we'll get a Star Trek film? Like 2022?
Oh, my God. Well, at this point, like, productions are a little shaky. Jeez. I mean, 2022 at the best case scenario, but even that might be a stretch. I think we might be looking more at 2023.
So it could be kind of a similar gap between what we had from Nemesis to Star Trek 2009, then, between films.
And at that point, does it make sense to bring back the Kelvinverse group when you've got how many years?
well, you know what? It just makes me think of how the TOS crew is looking by the end of that film franchise of theirs.
Well, I've always dreamed of having Pike and of having Chris Pine, I should say, not Pike, and all that crew together into the age of the crew in like Star Trek, The Undiscovered Country. I think that would be amazing.
You want a movie where you see them taking off the motion picture uniforms and just strapping on those awesome burgundy uniforms right at the very end, right?
That's right. And I want the final credits to be the signatures in space again, but I want to see it signed William Shatner and then a line go through it and put Chris Pine.
I'm down for that. Do we get to watch Chris Pine wear reading glasses and feel really insecure about it throughout the entire movie?
There is no way Chris Pine's doing that.
Okay, Noah Hawley, even if you're not pursuing a Kirk movie, we're giving you gold right here. So just think about it if your movie is taken off the back burner.
That's right. So maybe we should get back to Much Ado About Boimler.
Sure.
The focus of this week's episode of the podcast.
Yeah. Cam, Boy Me Up, that is a Tyler joke right there. I got a good laugh out of me.
Yeah. I thought this was a really fun episode. It had two stories going on at the same time that I thought each of them had a lot of energy. They felt different enough. Like, that was kind of my issue last week, was it felt a little too samey, the two stories going concurrently. I felt like these two stories really worked and gave us some really fun character stuff.
Yeah, well, they mixed up Tendi and Boimler. Like, it used to just be, you know, Tendi Rutherford and then Boimler Mariner for the last couple episodes. I mean, I'm glad that we threw Tendi into the equation with her very frightening, demonic-esque dog that had to be investigated by Division 14, along with the sort of phasey Boimler, which, as far as transporter accidents go, Cam, I would probably take Boimler's transporter accidents than all the other ones we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking last week about how, you know, that episode tackled, you know, the holodeck characters breaking loose, one of the biggest go-to tropes in Star Trek. And another go-to trope we see all the time is transporter accidents. And I thought it was really fun to see this one here where, you're right, I don't really need to see those terrifying worms that Barclay faced down is it Realm of Terror or something like that?
Realm is in there, right? It's I'm sorry, Night Terrors. That's a different one.
Yeah.
Dang, this is going to chew on us right now.
Or is it Realm of Fear or something like that?
I think
like
it's Realm of Fear. I'm pretty sure it's Realm of Fear. Yeah.
Okay. So anyways, yeah, I don't need to see those types of terrifying worms. I thought this was a really funny, comedic way to approach it, where it's making the beaming sound the whole time. It's something you can only do in animation. I think that's something they're smart to stick to, is the types of problems that would not work on Star Trek Picard.
Could you imagine, if it was a transporter accident on an episode of Enterprise and it was just like Travis Mayweather walking around half phased in with a whoo sort of noise?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it would not work. Animation is the only place you can do this. And I thought it was handled very well, and it was funny.
Cam, I can't believe it. There was kind of an Enterprise episode like that. Remember Daedalus in season 4, one of the worst episodes?
Oh.
It was inventor of the transporter came to visit, and they realized his son was kind of lost in like this transporter realm or something.
Yeah, that was Emery Erickson, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was okay. Well, this is much more amusing than that episode.
That episode was depressing to sit through.
Because spoiler alert for a 15-year-old episode, but the son was dead, ain't coming back.
Yeah, and it was just depressing as well because it was very boring.
Yes, it was. there weren't even stars in that one. They had to go to like an area of outer space where they couldn't see stars for some reason. That never made sense to me because you're literally in the Milky Way and you're never not going to see stars.
Enterprise season 4 is like all killer, no filler, with an asterisk next to it that says Daedalus.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, what'd you think about Division 14, though? The Starfleet division that solves or that investigates unsolvable medical mysteries and diseases.
I thought this was really fun. Again, it's another Star Trek concept that fans, I don't think, have debated this, you know, an insane amount over the years, but the idea of introducing another element to Star Trek canon that's kind of fun. Yes, this Division 14 that I loved, that was headed, or at least in this case, it was picking them up was an Edosian. And it's been a long time since we've seen an Edosian, and I was very excited to see one. And at first I thought it was actually voiced by Kelsey Grammer, but I was inaccurate on that.
He's due for a cameo. He was due for a convention appearance as well, but who knows if that will happen, considering how things are going in Las Vegas. But I also love the Edosian's uniform, where he's got like himself a little cape with like the Starfleet insignia on it. So that's something that I could picture somebody wearing at the convention too.
And I love that he had a very, very different personality than Eric's did on the original animated series, because often in Star Trek, they tend to match up alien races and their personalities quite a bit. I mean, we see it with Vulcans all the time. And I like that this Edosian was drastically different in personality than Eric's.
Yeah, look, Alexander Rozhenko and Volk from Discovery.
Tyler, you just named two characters who are replicas of one another.
but with regards to his personality, I was rolling my eyes where, you know, Boimler turns into kind of the little quizzling there and tattles on all the freaks that are trying to fight back. And the Edosian grabs a rifle and starts threatening everybody with it. And then at the end, he's like, yeah, maybe I should have talked it out. I'm like, dude, you've been on this farm route for like a long time. Is this actually the first time that people have gotten sick being in like this trip for like months on end?
Yeah, I don't want to know what happened in the other circumstances. I mean, I'm willing to go with the logic of this scenario just for the joke of this character who comes across as incredibly evil and has a maniacal laugh and is just like, well, actually, I'm just a nice guy. I just laugh like this, and maybe we should paint this place a little brighter.
Well, you know, dramatic misdirect, I suppose. But Boimler sure got lucky, though, in that like his phase issue just dramatically disappeared, and then he lands on the farm planets when they all thought they were going to push him out the airlock, and his trip to the farm was only a few days versus the months and months other people had to spend.
Yeah, that's right. I thought, again, this was another fun payoff of them landing at the farm, and it's like heaven. It's utopia. I mean, it's just another example. I think this show, honestly, is going to have a lot of fun with situations where Boimler just gets the rug pulled out from under him. Like, he's that character who's perfectly set up to constantly just be undercut in his desires or expectations. And it was so much fun where the two female, I don't know, nurses, I guess, or what, doctors or technicians?
They didn't really establish what they were. They're grabbing Boimler by the arms and saying, hey, cutie. Like, I don't know if those are medical professionals, but hey, whatever.
You haven't met my doctor.
The one who delivered you, the one who's now 85 years old.
She still thinks I'm a baby. Yeah. She's like rocking hey, me cutie. In her arms.
Hey, cutie.
I get lollipops every time I go.
Yeah, it's like that Robert Munsch book where like the mother crawls through the window and like rocks the 40-year-old man in her arms. You know the one I'm talking about? Like,
For
as long as I love you, forever you'll be, or you know the one I'm talking about?
Oh. That does ring a bell. Yeah, that does totally ring a bell. Yeah.
it is kind of a frightening book, though, if you think back. Like, I remember being a kid being kind of creeped out, like this old lady was rocking her 40-year-old son in her arms while she's like broke into his house late at night.
Is that weird?
Well, yeah. It's true. Your mom still does that, so.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And she live streams it on Facebook.
We had 10 hits on the last one.
We'll get you up to 11 after this podcast airs.
That's right. But yeah, I loved when the women came over and like, we have dibs on this cutie. They're like, oh, he's cured. Time for you to go. Yeah. It's like, I think just he's a character because he's just such a wired up, like high wired character who's just... He's always kind of jumping to conclusions or making himself... I don't know, basically setting himself up to fail. I love how the show constantly makes him fail for comedy value, and I think it totally works every time.
Well, I think there's so much to mine if they go back to the well of, you know, these little experiments going wrong, whether it's Rutherford messing up with his efforts to make the transporter go a couple seconds faster, or if it's Tendi creating the dog that eventually can fly and talk and bark lightning out there.
Yeah, that dog I thought was pretty amazing too. I did like the big reveal of it talking at the end. I thought that was very funny and appropriately surreal.
Yes. I got to ask you though, okay. Did you notice the name of the Division 14 ship?
I just saw the NX75300.
Yeah, it was called the Osler. And to recall a couple of weeks ago, I'll just spill the beans. Osler Street is a street in Marpole, and one of the shuttles on the USS Vancouver was the shuttlecraft Marpole. Somebody is really big into that very nondescript Vancouver neighborhood where, Cam, you've been there many a times. It's low-rise apartment buildings and some detached homes. There's not a lot going on in Marpole. I don't get the obsession that the animators seem to have with that neighborhood.
Well, could someone live there who works on the animation staff?
That's my best guess. Because, look, I went and did like different configurations of the NCC 73 or 753000, and I played around with it. I tried to find out if it was like an address or something at all notable. No, just houses. So I was like, okay. But would you really want to put your home address on a widely broadcast television series for people to figure out?
My address? No. But a coworker's address? Comedy gold.
Oh, okay, I got you there. I got you. what'd you think of the Mariner storyline? Let me get your thoughts first, and then I'll go into one of the concerns that was allayed for me the second time that I watched it.
Okay, the Mariner story, it was kind of just weird to watch her just play the bumbling fool in a lot of scenarios, but I do like that they set it up as self-sabotage. I think what I enjoyed about this the most, though, was that it tackled a story that we never really got in Star Trek, which is a real examination of rank mixed with like social situations, because obviously Mariner is close friends with a captain. What does that mean actually on duty? That's something we didn't get a lot of on the other, you know, live action Star Trek shows. And I thought it was really fun to see it handled here.
I just remember Sisko mentioning once in an episode how it was weird the first time he went from ensign to lieutenant junior grade and his friends started to have to call him sir. He said it just kind of felt weird at that time. And but beyond that, you're right. Like just that friendship versus rank structure hasn't seemed to be as an issue like you would expect it to be in Star Trek.
No, I mean, I'm trying to think of examples where it really comes into play. A lot of the time, the senior staff just kind of hang out with the senior staff on the show. So you don't even approach those topics.
There was a great moment in Move Along Home, I think, in which O'Brien did not have to go to the first contact meeting with the Wadi. He's like, I'm an enlisted man. You guys have fun as the officers going to this meeting. I'm just going to hang out at home.
Right. Yeah. That is a good example. Another one actually DS9 related. I think a little bit of the relationship between Sisko and Nog when he's, you know, new into Starfleet. Like, it's definitely a very formal relationship, even when they're not on duty.
Well, I also like how Bashir told O'Brien, well, you're going to have to start calling him sir now.
Yeah, exactly. And it is kind of weird because you think of all the Star Trek series and the amount of mixing around to cast members on any given episode, but you never really got this examination of like a social life with rank as much. I don't know why. It seems like rife for exploration.
I guess the next closest thing we can point to is the TNG episode, Lower Decks, where you had Ben the bartender, who didn't really see after that episode. But apparently he was good friends with both the junior officers and the senior officers.
Sure he was.
Yeah. So good, we never saw him again.
Yeah, do you think that's a little awkward when they do something like that in that episode, but that character isn't even in the next episode?
It was very sitcom-y, where it's like, the kid has a best friend at school, then we never see the best friend in another episode.
Or the Poochie thing, you know, with the Roy showing up at the family house. Yeah, it's like, well, I'm out of here. It's like, okay, well, sure thing.
Yeah. With regards to the Ramsey dynamic, I was worried that we were going to get yet another story of Mariner kind of just slacking off, not really caring until, chips were down and she had to really like buckle in and do her best job. I'm just like, I feel like we've gone to that well with that character a number of times already. And so I was watching this unfold, I was just kind of groaning to a certain degree. Like you said, they do reveal it as she is kind of engaged in self-sabotage here because she does not want to get an offer to go jump aboard the USS Oakland. I appreciate that they are trying to hit, you know, different sort of notes with that character, even if it does seem like some territory that seems a little familiar with Mariner.
Yeah. And, you know, I did agree with you, though, that it felt frustrating the first time through, because the thing is, I've seen Mariner be very competent, maybe in an unconventional way, but nonetheless very competent in tense situations or just duty situations. And so it was kind of frustrating to make her, like, the show felt like it was, or at least it came across to me like they were making her just seem kind of dumb. And I very much appreciated that that wasn't the case at all.
Did Captain Ramsey have to be on the same sort of command fast track that apparently Commander Riker was on when we did the math a couple years ago?
She must have, right?
Yeah, because remember, we did the math and we figured out from the time that he graduated Academy to the time that he was offered his first command in like season two or season three of Next Gen, he had only been in Starfleet for 7 years. And I'm just like, wow, that guy really had the opportunity to be captain quite quickly. And it seems as if, you know, Ramsey seized on that, whereas Mariner has been wallowing around as an ensign for quite some time. Although, had they not said before that she was demoted? We obviously saw that episode early on where she was promoted to lieutenant and then being demoted again. But had she been a lieutenant or higher before we found her in episode one?
I am racking my brain and I'm not 100% sure. Yeah. I know that she'd been on another ship at a certain point and bombed out and wound up on the Cerritos, but I can't remember if it was in a higher position or if it was just another ensign job.
I think what I might be getting mixed up in my head, though, is I think at the Star Trek panel, Mike McMahon, the creator, they were doing outlines of the characters and they're talking about Mariner saying that, oh yeah, she gets promoted and demoted all the time. So then when I went into the series, I had just assumed maybe she had already been promoted and demoted. And then I think maybe what he was just referring to was that, I think episode two or three, where she joins the senior crew and maybe she's demoted by the end again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And look, we saw a couple episodes or maybe last episodes, based on Fletcher getting that promotion. It seems very easy to get promoted in Starfleet.
It does. And yet people don't get promoted that much on the live action shows.
Sorry, Harry Kim.
But you think about, you know, all the Star Trek shows, it was very rare people got real promotions.
Deep Space Nine
was the odd one.
Deep Space Nine was very good about it. The other shows, not so much, you know,
Yeah, had Tom Paris getting a pip.
Deanna Troi got a promotion.
Yeah.
Geordi did. Worf did.
I guess TNG kind of wins the award for promotions, because did anyone get any promotions on Enterprise?
No, nobody.
Yeah.
Although T'Pol did, you know, shift from, you know, being sub-commander with Vulcan Expeditionary Group over to being, I guess, kind of field commission of commander aboard the Enterprise in Starfleet. But Deep Space Nine, you had Julian went from junior lieutenant to full lieutenant. Dax went from full lieutenant to lieutenant commander. Kira went from major to colonel. Sisko went from commander to captain. I guess it's just Odo that was stuck with the honorary title of constable throughout the entire run.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, just how many people on DS9 got promotions. I didn't even think of Bashir. And I guess you could even slightly count Nog going from cadet to ensign.
Yeah, I'll count that. Did he get a lieutenant's pip by the last episode, or am I just making that up in my head?
Yeah, because...
Didn't Kira tell Nog that the last order, you know, that Sisko gave was to give Nog a promotion to lieutenant?
I think that's right, isn't it? Because the way he stayed behind on DS9,
no, what, I feel what, like you, he... what you leave behind.
I feel like you would get a promotion for that job. I don't think like just leaving an ensign behind makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, although I think for the longest time I had it in my head that he took over Chief O'Brien's job. But then when we recently rewatched that episode, I realized I don't think they ever explicitly said that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also like how you've gone from calling it, you used to always call it what we leave behind or what you leave behind. Then you started calling it what we left behind. And now I'm teasing you, pretending that you call it what he left behind.
I'm just going to call it What He Left Behind from now on, and it's always going to be a reference to Nog.
That's perfect there. Well, hey, by the time that we got to season 8 of Deep Space Nine in the special animated parts of that documentary, he was Captain Nog by then.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. I always get mixed up with like the future of the Nog character because of, that documentary, obviously. I mean, we can debate back and forth how canon it is, but yeah, it did definitely set a certain, basically, direction career-wise for that character.
I'm happy accepting it as head canon, and if there's anything that comes about in one of the other series that somehow disregards what happened in the documentary, that's fine with me. I'll go with the official canon in that case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ezri was a captain in that documentary, wasn't she?
Yeah. And I think that, speaking of promotions. Yeah. Ezri, I think, started as Ensign Ezri, and then she got bumped to Lieutenant Junior Grade in like by episode 3, I think.
That was a very fast trajectory in one season.
Well, maybe she had been an ensign for, you know, like 4 years at that point, and she was due for the promotion.
Yeah, quite possibly.
So
yeah.
Deep Space Nine promotes pretty much everybody who's within their ranks there, right?
Yeah, seems like it, yeah.
Quark, he just promotes his holosuite programs.
You don't want to go to that promotion ceremony.
Remember he did do those advertisements that like ran on like the comm systems? Like there's like that commercial like or something?
I do, but I also get those mixed up with the toy commercials that Armin Shimmerman was in as Quark.
Those are pretty classic commercials. So I like how they sped up the speed of it. So like he's talking at like, if you're listening to a podcast at like 1.5 speed.
It would be like you'd be going back in time if you were to listen to that commercial in at 1.5 speed.
It's almost like Superman going around the planet Earth to go back in time too.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. So the Mariner stuff. There was a great line there where Ramsey turns to her and says, "Come on, be honest. Have you seen Ransom's photon torpedo?"
Yeah, I had questions about that because it really made me wonder. What is the protocol going on these ships?
I don't know. It's unclear. I don't think Starfleet's ever been portrayed as being too picky about letting people mix and mingle. But I think things get tricky if you are within the same division, like where somebody could be in direct command of you. So in this situation, I don't, you know how like Ransom was putting the moves on Ramsey by the end. And I think that's fine. He might be a commander. She's a captain, but they don't serve with each other. Whereas with Ransom and Mariner, I think, you know, she's in command division. He's in command division. He is going to be in a situation where he would be directly giving her commands, and that's kind of a power imbalance. And I just don't think that we get into some weird territory when it's commander v ensign in a relationship, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I can go with it for the sake of comedy on the show, but when we actually examine it in terms of like a workplace scenario, it gets a little questionable. How? Especially with Ransom, because it's not like Ransom is a particularly upstanding fellow.
We both really like the episode Lessons, in which Neela Darren, the lieutenant commander in Stellar Cartography, and Picard pursue a relationship. And was there a moment where Picard said quite explicitly, like, yeah, we'll have to file paperwork to Starfleet or something?
No, I would have loved that scene, though.
Okay. I thought there was some sort of acknowledgement that there was, like, he was the captain and she was a commander.
Was there?
I could be mistaken. I had in my head somehow.
All I think about is Troy having to go to Picard to talk about her being in a relationship. I don't remember something in Lessons, but it's been a while since we watched that episode.
Okay. What relationship was that that Troy went to?
I don't remember, but there was one where she had to tell him like that she was in a relationship with someone.
Oh, but it wasn't somebody within Starfleet. I think wasn't it like a wasn't that like Man of the People or something?
Something like that. It's just like that popped into my head as that scene being kind of similar to Picard having to file paperwork.
But that was a dumb scene because like she's getting involved with a civilian. Like, you know, I don't think she needed to go to her commanding officer to keep him informed about her relationship status.
Yeah, it's not like Riker's doing that.
No. And besides, they must have some sort of social media platform that lets people know if you're single or things are complicated.
It's always complicated on Star Trek. There's no other setting.
Just stunned. Another line I like when, you know, Rutherford didn't have much to do, but he did save the day at the end. He just says, don't worry, it's just cosmetic. And then Ramsay starts cheering. It's just cosmetic when everybody's looking at their phased bodies.
I thought that was good. I felt like Ramsay, I like the character. I would like to see more of Ramsay on the show, but I felt like that character didn't quite have enough funny moments. Like, it didn't really come across as that funny a character on the show.
Oh, she made the photon torpedo joke. That's true. That might be my favorite line of the entire episode.
You may have me there. Yeah, you're right. She did get that one. Yeah, that one's a pretty funny joke.
Mariner had my second favorite line, though, where the dog is first introduced, and then she just turns over in her bunk and says, "Wake me up if it turns into something I need to care about."
That was also a very good line. I also really enjoyed the callback to Threshold, where there's like the lizard creature in the on the district
Division 14. Anthony.
Yeah, the Division 14 ship. And they're like, "Is that human?" And they're like, "We're assuming."
Yeah. Probably my favorite sight gag, though, is they land on the farm and it's just the woman in the pike chair rolling up to other people in pike chairs.
Oh, and wearing Hawaiian shirts on top of their pike chair.
That is a cosplay outfit right there you got to do.
As soon as I saw the first pike chair, I laughed. When I saw three of them in Hawaiian shirts, I mean.
I just love how pike chairs are still quite ubiquitous, you know, like 100 years after that episode, after the menagerie.
No kidding. I mean, it is so funny when you think about that episode, the menagerie, and it being basically them just being desperate to fill time on the, you know, on the air dates for the show and just taking the cage and stretching it into two episodes. And yet it produces some of the most iconic things in the franchise with, you know, obviously real focus on those pike chairs.
Well, one of the executive producers of Strange New Worlds had like one of the like legit hilarious line, though, when they're talking during the panel the other week, though. But they're talking about how the cage it indicates it's the longest pilot to series order pickup in all of television history, where it literally takes like 55 years for like the cage to air until they finally say, "We'll make a show out of that." And I'm sorry, the cage did not even air. It only screened in front of executives who said, "Nah, give it 55 years.
Yeah. It wasn't until like 1985 or something like that, where it really started getting any sort of airing.
Well, I think it aired for sure in syndication during the writer's strike of season two of TNG, just because they're just looking for any content to fill the airwaves at that point, which is also right. Why we got, you know, Shades of Grey.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Recycled footage for the win.
Yes, but I think we won out with the cage in that situation.
Yeah. I had a question for you. When Ramsay showed up with her fellow officers that she had with her senior staff, was that one of them a Rigelian? Because I actually was staring at it, thinking, trying to figure out what it was, pulled up a photo of the Rigelians from Enterprise on my phone, and it looked very similar. But the only difference is Rigelians are usually portrayed as being green versus purple.
I just remember the Rigelians looking like Ninja Turtles, and this guy didn't really look like a Ninja Turtle to me.
I know, but it's like all the markings on the eyes were exactly the same. That was the thing that threw me. Like the lines that went from like the eyes to the mouth or whatever were all like replicas of the ones from Enterprise. That's what threw me.
I thought it was maybe the same species as Jayla from Star Trek Beyond just because of the markings. But I don't know. I did not investigate like you did.
Yeah, you know what? Jayla's species is another good call, maybe. Maybe they were just going for a generic alien that had similar qualities as ones we've seen before. I don't know.
Well, you know, I bet Memory Alpha has something up already. I think the guy's name was Durga, if that makes sense. Does that
ring
a bell?
Yeah, I think so. They like basically announced those three names in unison, or basically one after another, I should say. And I was like, didn't really catch any of those.
Yeah. One of them was a vaguely Vulcan name. I was just like, sure.
Yeah. I did also really enjoy the other aliens that we met in this episode, the ones down on the bog planet
they're
or whatever.
They had an amazing name. They're called the Osmos.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of the original Star Trek animated series tackling aliens that would never... They just wouldn't make sense in live action, and this is another really good example of that. I like that these kind of had a similar soft kind of like toy-like look as the like Care Bear lookalikes we saw in the pilot for Lower Decks. It's that similar look of being very cartoony, but really fun.
See, I thought you were going to say that you've always loved Osmosis Jones, and that's why you're a big fan of these Osmos aliens.
I have seen Osmosis Jones. I have almost no memory of it, though.
Also animated.
Yes, it was. Half animated.
Maybe we can get Bill Murray in on Bill Murray can show up in live action on an episode of Lower Decks.
There is no way they're booking Bill Murray for Lower Decks. I don't even know if they'd be able to get hold of him.
Some people are able to get a hold of him. He still does gigs and appearances, you know.
Yeah.
He's for hire.
Does, yeah.
Yeah. Make it happen. He might be a big Star Trek fan. Who knows?
I think they have a better chance getting, if we're going to talk about SNL veterans, I think they have a better chance of getting Eddie Murphy, who's a genuine Star Trek fan.
That would actually be, he can bring up the Mushu voice, right?
Yeah. You know, we almost got him in Star Trek 4. It's his belated, you know, arrival into the franchise. We need to make this happen at some point.
I would love it if he just plays himself in an episode of Lower Decks. And he's wearing that red leather outfit.
Yeah, well, and not using some of that material from that.
No. That film, has not aged well.
Has not aged well, but I do think there is something to be said for the idea of revisiting the idea of contemporary celebrities on the holodeck. I just think you have to be very careful about who you pick. I loved how they had, you know, Stephen Hawking back on TNG, but like Joe Piscopo, that one didn't age so well.
Who would be a great one that you know would not age so well?
That would not age well.
Yeah. Like somebody who's very hot right now, but you just know that maybe they're going to be burning, their candle will burn bright, but maybe not that long.
Kylie Jenner?
I don't know. She's like a billionaire. I know. Think she's got like staying power.
I was going as superficial as I could. But yeah, you're right. Like Kim Kardashian has stuck around for the long term against all odds. So
maybe the Octomom.
Oh my god. But that's like completely out of date by the time they're getting her on the show.
That's what makes it even better. It's the Octomom.
Well, you know what? Star Trek has never been on the ball when it comes to actually doing things that are cool when they're cool. They come to it years later.
Music?
Rod Stewart music.
It'd be great if, yeah, they just had like an 80s synth band appear in the holodeck, you know?
Sure.
What was Trent Reznor's like Exotic Birds? Yeah, Trent Reznor's 80s band.
Oh god, yeah.
There you go.
Or they bring like Tom Green on the show.
He's doing the Bum Bum song.
Yeah, exactly.
He actually did like a really good like rap song. Do you remember it? It's organized rhyme called Check the OR. Did you ever hear that song?
Yeah, it was played on Much Music here in Canada. Much Music is like the MTV equivalent. And yeah, that song was played quite a bit.
I know it'll come to a surprise for a lot of the American listeners. It got a lot of play in Canada, but I know we're saying it's Tom Green, but it's actually a legit good hip hop song from like old school, early 90s hip hop. And I know it won like a Juno Award, which is Canada's Grammys. Look, if you think the Grammys are worthless enough, just think about the Canadian Grammys. But yeah, I don't know. I'll give it a listen, folks.
We should also mention now that we've won 3 Junos this year.
Yeah.
There was one other thing I was going to add, though, in terms of this episode of Lower Decks, which is the finale, basically what happened with this ship that was overtaken by the alien species. Very much a recalling of Encounter at Farpoint, I thought.
Yeah, what did you think is the best, you know, spacefaring species we've met so far? The Encounter at Farpoint 1, we also had the Crystalline Entity. Maybe you could count Loss, you know, from Deep Space Nine. We also had the booby trap space whales, the Gormaganders. They like their space entities here in Star Trek. I don't mind.
They really do. You know, the one that keeps coming back to me is honestly the floating jellyfish in Encounter at Farpoint. Like, that's not a great episode of Star Trek by any stretch of the imagination. We ranked it pretty low when we ranked the pilots of Star Trek. But that image of those giant jellyfish, I still, like, it still sticks with me. I think it's very effective and has that certain awe of the unknown.
Do you know what also sticks with those jellyfish? Apparently gravity, based on the way that they move in outer space.
Very true. The cosmic dance.
Cam, what would Encounter of Farpoint be like if Q was not involved in the episode, as this was originally supposed to be just a 1 hour series premiere?
Right. So is this just a 1 hour, or are we still stretching it to 2 hours?
No, it's just the original idea, the 1 hour premiere. It was only going to be about Farpoint Station, and Q is not going to play a part.
Are we still calling it Meeting at Farpoint?
It's called Meeting at Farpoint, and it's just about...
get rid of the apples. Don't show the apples. I told you not to do that with the apples.
Right. And then, like, 5 minutes of exploding footage of models. Yes. At the end. Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be good, but it would probably just be one of those kind of lousy season one TNG episodes that we don't really talk about other than to kind of laugh at.
I'm just saying, like, the sheer charisma of one John Delancey elevates that episode in a way that I think we should be more thankful for.
Yeah, because also the Q stuff gives Patrick Stewart a real chance to shine in that pilot. If you remove that, Patrick Stewart really gets kind of mixed in with all the other crew members who are all doing things to various degrees throughout the Farpoint stuff. So you don't get that captain showcase that I think is so important in setting him up as the defender of humanity.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to think, any final thoughts here that jumped out to you? Like, this episode for me is not quite up there with maybe the last couple, but I still found it quite delightful myself.
Yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun. It's not quite as good as I wasn't as big on last week's episode, but the episode before that, the Cupid's Errant Arrow. Yeah, like, that one I thought was just fantastic. That is, I think, my favorite so far of the series. This one falls, I would say, high middle, where I really enjoyed it. And again, the show is doing exactly what I wanted it to do after the first couple episodes, of just slowing down just a little and telling good stories for each of the characters. And I like that the show has finally figured that out and it's doing it well. And I mean, we are almost at the end of the season. We've only got 3 episodes left, but I'm really looking forward to seeing how this all wraps up.
Well, just a little side note as well. I started watching a live action series on Amazon Prime called The Boys, and it stars Jack Quaid, who does the voice of Boimler. It is bizarre to, like, not be familiar with Jack Quaid outside of Star Trek Lower Decks, only know his voice, and now I'm watching him in live action, like, do kind of the Boimler voice in kind of a sometimes dramatic role. It's a little surreal, but entertaining nonetheless.
And you also have Carl Urban, a real Trek connection there on The Boys.
Oh, and Simon Pegg is in it as well, so it's like there are many a Star Trek connection in this series.
Speaking of Star Trek connections, Nolan North, who did the voice of the Edosian in this episode, was a crew member on the USS Vengeance in Star Trek Into Darkness.
Oh, was he in, like, one of those purple uniforms that they made them wear?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Well, don't remember you, Nolan North, but I thought that was a great Division 13 character. So great, I can't remember your character's name. And Division 14, not 13, I should say.
You don't want to know what Division 13 is.
Ooh, sounds unlucky.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Episode 8, Cam. We're still doing Star Trek Lower Decks. How many times do I have to tell you before we start recording? We're just going to review the next episode. Get it through your head.
I'm like the guy from Memento. I never remember by the time we get to the end of the episode.
It just says, you've just scribbled, like, John G all over your body.
I just keep tattooing the word Boimler all over my body.
Yep. Hey, Cam, can I offer you a cup of coffee?
What was the, I don't.
Oh, remember Carrie Ann Moss's character spit into the cup of coffee to.
Oh, of course. Yeah,
just to
test
if the guy was really faking it or not.
Right. Yeah. All I was thinking about when you said that was, I was going, wait, how does that relate to insulin shots?
Oh.
Whole other section of Memento. Check out Memento if you haven't seen it. It's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in volatile plant seeds, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nolan North. I love you.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.